To the House Committee on Revenue. I will be sitting in for the chair today in case he grabs this gavel while he's sitting next to me and signals me that I'm inappropriately behaving.
Madam Chair, I just called your attention that I haven't seen my grandchildren since last year and that they'll be here sometime during this meeting. So if I grab anything, it's my books and papers, and I'm straight out the door.
All right. I understood, and we expect an introduction when they show up because we'd all like to meet them. So, Mr. Warner.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today is our second day of orientation. Before we get started, I wanted to just refer back to your public finance basic facts. This is our annual updated version, and we just completed it last Friday. So our orientations don't follow chronologically exactly as the book is, but you'll find a lot of this information plus a lot more in this as well. So I'm hoping you'll use this as a reference as we go through. So with that, Madam Chair, we're ready for Elizabeth is going to go through the income tax.
Okay, Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with Legislative Revenue Office, and I'm going to go through personal income taxes. I have many slides here, so we'll just see how we do, and if you have to stop me, I'm talking too fast, that's just fine. It's no big deal. Let me start by just saying, too, what else I've given you today. I mean, you have the overheads as far as a handout, but you also have this research report that we're just now releasing, and this is research report number 6-04. It's dealing with the earned income and working family child care tax credits in Oregon. So it kind of goes through some of that, talks about if you have policy changes, how much that would cost the state and things like that. So I have a few slides on that, but it's, you know, there's a lot more detail in this report. And then also what I've given you here, too, is that Department of Revenue, you know, each year puts out statistics. So I just want to make sure everybody's aware of what they put out. So in the income tax area, they've got a very thick book here on the personal income tax statistics. The most recent one here is 2002. But it really does give you, I mean, if you need any help trying to find things in there, it's usually always there. It just may take a little bit of effort to become familiar with the table. But this can give you a lot of good distributional breakdowns and stuff by different income groups for different, you know, different credits, deductions, subtractions, adjustments, all that we'll be going through today. So to begin with,
Elizabeth, just a brief. It served me a bit, committee members, to have the lights down a little bit, but not all the way down for the slides. What's your pleasure here? I'm not going to down just a little bit, Christy, but not. I still need to be able to read something else. I don't want it real dark, but down a little bit helps.
Yes.
So, thank you.
So we'll start in with just kind of giving you a real overview of, you know, the personal income tax statistics, the collections that we get, some of the trends that we're seeing in income tax. And then we'll go through some of the details of the personal income tax statistics. And this is something that's right up Representative Butler's alley. And then we'll...
This will put you to sleep.
That's right. And then we'll talk a bit about the kicker, just a calculation of the kicker. And then I've just got one slide at the end where I just want to touch base with some of the tips on when you're trying to look at legislative policy changes, what are some key things to kind of consider. So to begin with, this is one of the pages out of your basic facts. It's page 8-8, and it really is just kind of a summary of the history of the personal income tax versus the property tax versus corporate. And when you're looking at this, you can see now the blue line here being PIT being personal income tax. It is the largest revenue source for the state, and really only since the passage of Measure 5, you can see historically property tax has been the larger revenue source of both state and local government. But when we had Measure 5, then we started to see this decline then in property tax. So then, and in the 90s, we also saw a real taking off of the personal income tax with kind of the restructuring of our economy with the bringing in of high tech and whatnot. So that really brought in a lot of additional revenue. And you see that both in the corp. It's pretty, on this particular graph, it's kind of hard to get an understanding of the volatility that really is in the corp system. because this is, you know, a scale-wise is you know, so much smaller. The corp is a very small portion of our total general fund compared to personal income taxes. So basically, with what we see is that right here is the huge drop there that we experienced from last session. There was a drop there of 19%. It went, personal income tax went from $4.1 billion in 2001 to down to $3.7 billion in 2001-02. So, you know, that's what Paul was referring to in his presentation yesterday as far as that being the largest drop that we've seen in years. So to kind of give you a breakdown here of the general fund revenues, I'm just using 0305 versus 0103, and you can see then now we're with 0305 we're having the recovery begin, and so we obviously saw an increase in total revenues there of $700 million. But what you're also seeing is with Pitt here was when we were in the kind of recession period, it was 82% of total general fund. And then now it's back up to 87% of general fund. And then with corporate revenues, the corporate fell even faster and harder than personal income taxes did during our recession period. So corp dropped to 4% of our general fund. But now corp is really taking off, and that's why we will be, when we talk about the kicker, the corporate revenues have exceeded projections to the point that we now have a kicker. So, and that's the corp revenue has increased from 4% to 6% now of our general fund. Now, another key important point here is to look at these other non-tax revenues, and we had $896 million in the 0103 biennium. Well, that's because of the borrowing that we did. And then now we now in 0305 biennium don't have that same borrowing and influx of revenues. And other things that are in the other non-tax revenue are things like liquor apportionment, interest earnings, licenses and fee revenues. The other taxes are things, you can see that's been pretty constant, 4% in 0103 and 3% in 0305 biennium. Basically, these revenues just haven't grown as fast as the personal income tax and the corporate tax. But we've had gift and inheritance tax are in the other taxes categories, as well as cigarette, tobacco. And gift and inheritance taxes has increased significantly between 0103 biennium and 0305. But we did see some drop then in cigarette taxes, and so that's kind of a balancing then that went on in that category. Now here I just wanted to kind of begin to talk a little bit about some of the collections of personal income taxes. And so what a lot of people don't realize is that we really do collect a lot of our personal income taxes that are owed each year.
Oh. Question, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth, coming back to the gift and inheritance, Oregon would still be in effect a unified state. Tell me, are we collecting in gift taxes on gifts in excess of $10,000 or $11,000? Is that what is our annual exclusion exempt amount? And then how much, when you talk about annual or the current receipts of gift and estate taxes, can you break down how much is actually gifts? What is that, a gift tax return that's being filed?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where the details are, but the actual dollars collected in the gift tax, as reported by the Department of Revenue, is zero.
Zero. Okay.
So there isn't anything in that category.
Okay. All right.
So we can follow up and see, but they do continue to use that terminology on their monthly reports.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, if I may, I think the committee will probably be addressing issues relative to the inheritance tax, and that's why. Was a little bit concerned about the discussion of gift taxes, because if we delve into that very far, if there is currently a gift tax being collected, and it's really those still under a unified basis, I think, in Oregon, isn't it? So
there was question. There is none.
Okay. All right. There is none. So it is an estate tax that we're collecting. And that's what you're talking about actually being a very significant increase. Portion of that is probably as a result of the legislation which was passed in the 2003 session.
Representative Butler, that's correct, because that really went into effect in 2000, tax year 03. So that was shown up here in 03, 05.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, you know, just so everyone's clear, we will probably have more detailed discussion coming up, you know, entirely on estate taxes. And really, estate taxes is the term that we should be using. It just happens that that's the way it gets reported as gifts and inheritance.
Representative Boquist, you had a comment.
Yes, Madam Chair. Could you clarify, just to make sure I understand, you can do it, Elizabeth, you want to.
We will turn to Elizabeth, trust me.
The borrowing that we've generated in revenue, we're talking specifically the tobacco settlement borrowing. Mm-hmm. And is that secured or unsecured?
I don't remember, Paul. Is it secured?
Representative Boquist, the technical term for that borrowing is they're called appropriation credit bonds. Mm-hmm. They're not technically the borrowing with the backing of the general fund. So in that sense, they could, but the way the financial markets interpret them is that the state, in order to protect its reputation, would appropriate general fund dollars if it had to, in order to protect that revenue, so that in order to pay off that debt. So, what the state has done is use the master settlement revenue as its source to fund those. To make that repayment, but if that for some reason were to dry up and be insufficient, the state would not be legally obligated to use general fund, but would be morally obligated to back that up, at least in terms of the financial markets and credibility for future borrowing.
So in layman terms, like me, what we're saying is it's unsecured, but if we want to be able to have borrow money again someplace else, we're going to have to make good on it if it goes bad.
I would say.
Thank you. We are going to be having more information, I presume, on the current situation and our borrowing and recent. Mm-hmm. I can assure that we will get further into this, mm-hmm. Representative Boquist.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that's one of your issues on your work plan.
Thank you. Elizabeth. Unless there's further questions right now. Elizabeth.
So this next slide really just tries to break down the tax returns that we receive. And this is for tax year 2002. And one of the good things to just kind of keep in mind is the amount of withholdings and stuff that we are able to track, because in the personal income tax system, we collect so much of our tax throughout the year through withholdings of wages from people. And then we have some, so this is basically representing of the number of returns. It was like in 2002, 1.6 million returns. There was basically 1.2 million that actually had some kind of withholding. And that represents about 74% of all of our tax returns. Now, a large number of these returns then actually got refunds. Well, that refunds is correlated with the withholding. Mm-hmm. So basically, people paid in more than they actually needed to pay, and that's why they got the tax refund. And you can see that significant 983,631 returns versus 350,000 returns that actually had to pay something on April 15th of 2003 is quite a bit smaller. Now, the estimated payments are for those, you know, people who maybe are small businesses and they make four estimated payments each year. Also, if you know you're going to have something like a capital gain, then you would be making estimated payments in order to anticipate that tax liability.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth, if I count that up correctly, and there's about 2.6 million, you say, tax returns. Is that what we're seeing?
Representative Butler, yeah, this you can't really sum it entirely in the sense that you're going to have here. You've got tax withholdings and you've got estimated payments, and those two, you know, can be added together. But in the sense of how many actually these are tax refunds and taxes paid are really looking at the same returns versus these two are looking at the same returns. It's just really to dissect the tax return. There was only $1.6 million in total tax returns filed in 2002.
And these are individual returns?
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yeah, now this is just taking those same $1.6 million returns and looking at it in terms of the tax that's withheld. Now, basically, in 2002, we had 96% of all of our tax was paid during the year, okay, through our withholding. So, again, of the tax amount, $3.5 billion that was collected in 2002, $3.1 billion, 67% of that was through the withholding throughout the year. Estimated payments were 14% of that total tax burden. And then, again, these two just try to give you an understanding of, you know, basically how much was paid out by Department of Revenue in tax refunds versus the amount of tax that was paid with returns. And you can see it's real small. I mean, you know, less than 20% of the total amount of tax actually transpired in the April of 2003 period. You know, this withholding is really the major part of how we are collecting our personal income tax.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth, these are for 2002 returns that were filed and should have been due by April 15th of 2003, and the records are held open for some period of time. Can you kind of give us a snapshot of when we're saying it is 2002 revenue relative to the forecast and relative to the closure in any year? I know that certain collections in July are treated as June 30 payments, and that we actually budget for and treat that as having been received. Can you help me with that, please?
Because you know our forecast is of taxes collected,
Came
in the door, and they will refer to a particular tax year. So, say in this particular case in 2002. You know, all the taxes weren't collected, you know, and you can have extensions and things on your taxes and whatnot. So, I mean, it can go way beyond June of 2003.
But, Madam Chair, if I follow up, please. But this is through June 30 of 2003 is what it is.
Yeah, that's what our forecast does.
It isn't necessarily the returns. Every return it has a 2002 10-4 or a Form 40 on it, because you might be receiving 2001 or 2000 tax returns in this time frame, and that's considered 2002 income.
That's right. And so when we start looking at our forecast has, you know, can have numerous years of tax liability being brought in for particular fiscal year. So in 2002-03, it would have tax year 2002, but also it could have 2001. It could even probably have 2000. You know, just there could be amended returns, audits, and things that go on. So there's a variety of tax years that will actually come in slowly throughout the year. So, but when we're looking at our forecast, and when we get forecasts, which we'll all be discussing again in March and things, that is collections. So that's looking, and that's basically what this is too. I mean, in terms of just looking at, this is a tax year 2002. This is how much withheld. This is how much was in estimated payments for that tax year. But the collections, and my next slide, we'll be talking about withholdings and how much money is actually coming in the door in terms of collections.
Follow up.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is typically through June 30 of 2003. But doesn't the state hold its books open for some collections that are received after that period of time, and for how long, and what is the criteria for that?
You want me to answer? Madam Chair, this goes back to our previous financial crisis we had in the early 80s. There was a decision to count the first 10 working days of withholding receipts as part of the prior biennium. So the first 10 days of July, the withholding receipts that came in at that time were counted as revenue in the prior biennium.
Only the employer withholdings.
Right. Okay. Only the withholdings. And that actually has been changed and updated with the general accounting practices. It's now 30 days for those withholding receipts that can be identified with a June liability. Those are counted in the prior biennium. So they're part of that biennial forecast. So we won't be able to close the books on the 03-05 biennium until August, because we'll count those July receipts. It amounts to, I think this last biennium is about $130 million.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Question, if you would, please. I think what I, correct me if I'm wrong, so I understand here, either Elizabeth or Paul, when we see the revenue estimate at whatever point in time in March and then again in May, we're actually going to be seeing a revenue estimate of half of one tax year, one whole tax year, and half of the next tax year, correct? That's how it's going to be. So even though we're looking at the taxpayer, me, how I pay, which is January 1 to December 31st, when we see a revenue forecast for the state for a biennium, we're looking at parts of three different tax years under the... Okay, got it.
And Representative Bogus, even potentially more than that, if you have a settlement from prior year that corporations will sometimes have with a refund from a back tax. So,
okay.
But you're exactly right, though. It's going to be those
Thank
two.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we're beginning to get a good flavor of why there are so many economists in that office that we need to help us with this.
And Madam Chair, that was a good farm year at the Boquist Ranch. Had he paid his estimate on time, we wouldn't have had to borrow on the tobacco settlement bonds.
Well, Madam Chair, for the record, my accountant told me I better start doing it or I won't be here. I'll be
and Representative Boquist, we are not going to be discussing accountants here. Okay, any further questions? Okay, Elizabeth.
And I'll just mention, too, that, you know, when you see your revenue impact statements, it's the same idea. You know, we split it out. We assume that there'll be, you know, two tax years in a given fiscal year that would be the liability for that particular fiscal year. Okay, so this is basically, I know this is a difficult graph to look at. That's why you have color over there.
It kind of looks like Mount Hood.
Let's just try, because this is something that's real. Once you get a sense of what's going on with the slide, it is quite interesting. Now, the Department of Revenue has done a lot of work to take these withholdings that we are getting, and they go and they categorize them by the NAICS code, which is just a particular type of indexing that classifies all the different businesses and all the different companies into what is their primary industry. So if it's finance, insurance, or is it manufacturing. And so basically that's what this table is doing, is taking the withholding for a 12-month period of time. So when you're looking here, like, say, January of 2000, it's for the prior 12 months. It's a 12-month index, which starts with the beginning being the January of 1999. And then it's going to make this index then going forward, with the denominator being the 12-month withholdings of January 1999. So basically, just looking at this, you've got to just see the trends, in the sense that, you know, initially we saw that all the sectors in this black line here, the solid one, is the all sectors category here. And so basically we saw all sectors growing and withholding. And now what that means is that it means they were increasing as far as, you know, the number of employees that they were having from this January of 1999 being your base period. So they were increasing their withholdings. Either they were giving additional salary increases, they were hiring new people. There's a, you know, just think of how many things would cause your payroll to go up. And so basically you saw an increase until about January of 2001. And then this red line here, that's manufacturing. So then we started seeing the drop then in manufacturing. And this really shows you who was affected significantly, and manufacturing just fell significantly in their withholding until almost June of 2003. And then that's when you see then it taking off again. And then the recovery is, you know, kind of flattened out here, and it's going up. We have a nice little blip here. And this goes out until October of 2004. So basically what you can see, too, is look at these industries like this. This is healthcare here. Well, healthcare is recession-proof. I mean, it just, you know, kept going and going. And, you know, one little blip here, you know, about beginning of 2002, but it just kind of keeps going and going. And the same thing with, you know, this one here is finances and insurance. You know, the low interest rates have really helped the finance and insurance industries, you know, keep going. They've had a little bloop here and kind of towards the end of 2003, but they're still climbing. So this is just kind of an aerial view of our industries and which ones are kind of doing well and which ones were really hurt during the recession period. Now, this table here really was one that I presented at the beginning of the 2003 legislative session, and I just thought I would kind of jog people's memory for Representative Berger.
Oh, Elizabeth, I can assure you I remember this one distinctly.
And anyway, it just meant to really highlight which industries were hit the hardest, and that obviously was manufacturing, with their reduction in the amount of tax withheld. That's $89.7 million was reduced between this period of, you know, looking at an index for July of 2001 versus October of 2002. And then you see wholesale trade, which was another one of those lines that really dipped, $43 million, and construction, $29 million. And in information, which is like publishing companies and stuff, you know, $23 million. And even the professional science and technical services, there was quite a dip there, 7%. So you can see the, you know, mining took quite a dip on a percentage basis. Arts and entertainment also saw a reduction of 26%. Now, I'm taking these same industries, okay, that were the hardest hit last time, and I'm moving them forward and saying, okay, now how are they doing in October now of 2004? And this is looking at the lowest month then of basically that period of our recession. So with manufacturing, we've seen an increase, and that was, as we were just seeing in that base graph, you saw the red line starting to move up. So manufacturing has seen a growth now from its lowest month in 2001 recession to October of 2004, a growth of 5%. Wholesale trade has grown 16%. Construction has grown 12%. And you can see information, though, is one of those industries that still has from its lowest month in 2001 recession, is still down 5%. So it hasn't even really bottomed out yet of the recession period. And then arts and entertainment, same deal. They really have still been struggling, that industry has. Retail trade, though, has obviously gone up 12%. Utilities has gone up 22%. Housing and transportation has gone up 11%. And mining has gone up significantly on a percentage basis.
Elizabeth, I definitely remember this slide. But what this doesn't show, and maybe it does later, is how important each one of these sectors are to Oregon as a percentage. And I think that I'm just mentioning that. These are numbers that probably would be better understandable if you knew how important manufacturing is to our state as opposed to whatever the information category is.
Yes, Madam Chairman, that is correct. And I don't really have a slide to kind of show you those, you know, various employments by different sectors. We can have that discussion, but it really is more to just kind of help you see, too, when you know, many times you're going to get fielded with all sorts of bills targeted towards certain industries. And it's important, I think, for you to be able to kind of decipher, well, is this an industry that has struggled, you know, quite significantly in recent years? And so this is, you know, something like withholding can really kind of give you an understanding of that. And it's something that we can go in and dissect this, too, and thoroughly. So if you want more information on, you know, a particular aspect of wholesale trade, we can do that kind of a thing. We can go in and look at those particular sectors, and we'll look at the same thing on the corp side with the estimated payments.
Representative Colizio.
Elizabeth, a methodological question.
Mm-hmm.
The categorizing, you know, what constitutes manufacturing versus wholesale trade, is that pretty seamless across the state? Is that kind of a federal choice? And so if I were in New Jersey, the companies do you see what I'm saying? In other words, those categories, how different are they state by state, or is it pretty much there's a federal criteria?
Yeah, Representative, let me make sure I say your name right. Galizio?
That's beautiful.
Okay. All right. So, Representative, this is called the North American industry sector, okay, the NICS, that's what it stands for.
Okay.
So we're not even talking about just the United States, we're talking about Canada, Mexico. So, yes, this is something that has been approved by the federal government. It's in our all our employment data is categorized by NICS. And so, yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of discrepancy about, certainly about the big companies and stuff. Now, it's some of the smaller companies that cause the Department of Revenue a lot of havoc because it's hard for them to try to figure out exactly what this particular company is doing and where they should be categorizing their withholding. So I think it's hardest actually for the smaller industries in the state as opposed to really manufacturing.
Representative Boca.
I have two questions, Madam Chair. One is on the information line, and one on the arts and entertainment. Information, I'm assuming, is we're not seeing we're continuing to see a decline in information, not even an improvement, a decline, though it's not quite as steep. And then in arts and entertainment and recreation, am I correct in assuming it looks like we're not seeing as much tourism and we're not seeing as much consumer confidence in luxury spending items. Is that kind of correct?
Representative Boquist, arts and entertainment is just that in the sense it's not like hotels or
right.
motels or anything. That is okay. another category. But it's things like going to the movies mm-hmm. and, going to the art museum. And so, yeah, it's really that extra money that people have in order to be able to spend on recreational pleasure items. And this is just something that's one of the first things to be cut back during a recession. Okay. Now, this one I'm not going to give, much more credence because we've pretty well, hammered all this out. But this is just really looking at it in terms of a percentage reduction, again, in different industries. And the management of companies and enterprises is really one that is seen a real big growth now since the recession, and that's basically what the mining, education, agriculture has seen a growth since 2001 recession, and then these accommodations and food services, and that really is kind of looking a bit more at the tourism aspect that's already seen some growth going on since 2001. And as we talked about before, finance and insurance still taking off with a growth of about 34%. And public administration also has seen some growth, and that's just because we had such cutbacks in 2001, local and state, and then now we're beginning to have some of that come back. Okay, so that was kind of the big picture overview with just some of the trends and stuff in the income tax system. Now let's talk about some of the details. And the devil is always in the details when it comes to this kind of stuff. But we'll start in by just kind of going through think of this as a tax statement in terms of, we have our personal income tax, and we start here in Oregon at looking at the federally adjusted gross income, and what we are connected to is actually our federal taxable income. And there is a difference now between gross income and taxable income. Since 1997, Oregon has been permanently tied to that federal definition of taxable income. Now, what happened was last session, we had a bill in the legislature temporarily disconnected then from the federal definition of taxable income. And what really was the law of the discussion with House Bill, House Bill 2186, is that, at the federal level, they can run deficits. So if they do have big tax cuts, then that gets filtered through, and if we keep connected with the federal definition of taxable income, we could see a reduction then in our own income if the definition of federal taxable income changed. Now, one of the proposals we were hearing about was like dividends, that there was going to be a dividends exclusion at the federal level. And so that would be then a reduction in taxable income here in Oregon because we connect with the federal definition of taxable income. So that was part of the discussions from last session, was that we wanted to disconnect temporarily during this period where it was tough budget times to really make sure that we wanted to make the changes that were going to be made and we were willing to budget those reductions, if they were reductions, through our own legislative process. And so that's what we'll be doing this session, is we'll be having a big bill dealing with federal tax changes, and we'll be going through them and deciding what do you want to keep and what do you not want to keep. And then another component of House Bill 2186 was to keep certain adjustments, so that if there were changes that were made to depreciation in particular, then we would keep those depreciation changes, and we would connect with those federal law changes. And the reason for that was because there are certain things like depreciation which are on a schedule. So every year, you know, your property depreciates a certain amount. Well, if you have to keep two sets of books because you have, you know, property that is being depreciated on an Oregon schedule, but then you have another property that's being depreciated on a federal schedule because of other, you know, guidelines that are going on at the federal level, then that causes a lot of additional costs administratively for business owners and lots of residents. So that was something that was a real concern of the committee, so that's why we then are now keeping depreciation changes. And there's a list of various other ones, too, but depreciation is the biggest one that has an impact. So, just so everyone's clear, you know, most states that have a personal income tax system, they will either connect to the federal adjusted gross income or to the federal taxable income. Now, the difference being just these deductions that are allowed at the federal level. So, what we first have when we bring forward our federally adjusted gross income and then we bring and we look at Oregon additions. Now, this is income that the federal government does not tax, but Oregon does. So we're adding it back. So these are additional things. Now, things here are like interest on non-Oregon bonds. That's an addition that we bring forward. And this is something to keep in mind. If you start looking through our tax expenditure report and there's something that you want to consider as far as, well, you know, maybe if the federal government doesn't tax us, but Oregon should. Well, then what happens is the Department of Revenue would be adding a new line here, and it would be part of an Oregon addition. So we already have, you know, this kind of an Oregon addition category going on in our tax system. Adding another line is not a real big, hard thing to do. So that's just something to keep in mind. Then we also have we have additions, and then we have subtractions. Okay, and with subtractions, this is basically the opposite of addition. It's income that the federal government does tax, but Oregon does not. So these are things like we are allowed a federal income tax up to $4,000. So that becomes a deduction that we're now being allowed, and it's an Oregon subtraction. Other examples of subtractions are basically Social Security. The Social Security income is not that's subtracted. There's a portion of it that's taxable at the federal level. And then we, as most of you probably remember, then we have our deduction. So this really is kind of the big difference between, and it's things that policy-wise that policymakers have really discussed. But whether you connect to the federally adjusted gross income or do you connect with the federal taxable income, which is the bottom, you know, it's the result of subtracting off deductions. So, you know, the federal deductions are what you're getting when you connect to Oregon taxable income. And so, you know, you can have, here in Oregon, we have a standard deduction versus itemized deductions, and then depending on which ones are larger, then you would choose those deductions. But itemized-wise, we connect with the federal itemized deductions. So the big federal itemized deductions are things like the mortgage interest on your home, your property taxes, and we'll go through that. But that's just important to keep in mind where we have connected to federal law. And we have connected all the way down here to Oregon taxable income. So we connect with all these federal itemized deductions. And and we just have additions and we have subtractions. So, again, everyone's clear. This is, if you wanted to, you know, take something and make it a new subtraction here in Oregon, but it's taxed at the federal level, again, that's just another line item that you could add to the tax base.
Elizabeth, I consider this slide to be full employment for Representative Butler and his the full employment for CPAs and tax people slide. Is there some question? I mean, we all go brain dead when somebody starts talking about our taxes and the schedules and whatnot. But, and I'd like to kind of get through a lot, but I'd entertain questions if there's something.
Madam Chair, so that you're aware, if I could, I'd certainly want to advocate to making the system a whole lot easier, because it's easier on the folks over in Deborah's shop and the entire state system. I mean, if you could bring the audit process down to just say, is the federal return correct, and then, you know, Oregon's tax is a percentage of the federal, like Nebraska does, or there's two or three states that start from those kinds of things, that'd make it a whole lot easier, and I'd just soon go get an honest job.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And clearly we will be talking about a lot of these issues further. This is just sort of the quick. I'm glad we're doing overview easy stuff now. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Okay. So here just kind of shows you, I've got a few graphs here on the trends then in some of these large Oregon subtractions and deductions and credits and things. So basically we have an Oregon special medical deduction. And this has been, it's growing slightly. And for those, Representative Berger and Representative Butler will remember when we had Measure 30 go before voters, this suddenly became a huge issue, because there was a phase out in Measure 30 of the Oregon Special Medical Deduction for the elderly. So this is just for seniors who are over 65, or actually over 62. Then they can claim their medical and dental expenses up to 7.5% of their adjusted gross income. And then they already get their medical expenses if they have a large amount of that, if it's above 7.5% of their adjusted gross income. That's on the federal level as a deduction. But this, or in here in Oregon, we were allowing, or we still allow, those additional medical deductions for small amounts. So this became a big issue with Measure 30, and as you can see, this is a subtraction that has grown significant. We have a whole research report if you're interested at all in this particular subtraction. Okay, so then other subtractions are things like military active pay duty, scholarship awards for housing expenses and things, federal pension. So this is something that is only for the federal service that was before October 1st of 1991. And then that becomes prorated if you had some of your service before October 1st of 1991 and some after. So this is something that this federal pension subtraction, it's been pretty constant, and, you know, eventually it should start to decline because the federal retirees will be getting older. And then we've got bond interest here on U.S. government bonds. Oregon tax refund is a subtraction. This is the Social Security income I was talking about. So all Social Security is not taxed here in Oregon. And then the federal income taxes. So this is our federal tax liability. This becomes a critical part when we start looking at changes that are going on at the federal level. So then what happens is, you know, not only could we have a change in the definition of taxable income, but just having federal tax liability be reduced means that then there's a connection with our Oregon income tax. And how it's connected is right here through this federal income tax subtraction. Okay, so when you have less liability at the federal level, then you can't claim as much of as large a federal income tax deduction. So that's the connection there. So even when we see the federal law changes reduce federal liability, it's not like the impact here in Oregon will be zero. type, there's still a connection because we are connected through this deduction here of federal income taxes. Now, this limit here is, this became a whole discussion after Measure 88 passed, I guess it was about November of 2001 or two. I think it was November of 2001. Well, it was right before we came into the 01 session, because it was an it was some of our 2002 special sessions where we then went and changed this so that Measure 88 originally had the federal income tax deduction increasing to $5,000, and that was approved by voters. But then the legislature came in during the 2002 special session, and they were looking for additional revenue, so they phased in that increase in the federal income tax deduction. So now we've got it at $4,000 here in 2002. It'll go up to $4,500 in 2005 and all the way up to $5,500 by 2007, and then it's indexed after that. So, again, this is something that was voted on to have an increase by voters, but then we just delayed that because of the recession.
Representative Butler has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Elizabeth, so that I know or have a pretty good idea what's happening here, based upon this schedule, then for tax year, one of the most recent tax, 2003, looking at the Social Security income, Oregonians received approximately $1 billion plus of, in that particular year, $1 billion plus in Social Security receipts.
Right.
Now, is that the portion of the receipts that were shown on the federal returns as taxable, or is that the total receipts?
This is the amount of Social Security that was taxed
on
at
the federal
level.
On the federal return. Okay. So follow up, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So that if Oregon, if we didn't have a constitutional provision which precluded this from doing so, if Oregon could tax the Social Security receipts at, let's say that the average rate was 8% out of a 0 through 9% bracket, because they're really not taxed on the federal return until they're up in some higher brackets anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were at 8% and there's a billion plus, that could generate the equivalent of $80 million, say, in 2003. For a biennium, it would be a $160 million item, potentially.
Representative Butler, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're looking at
and I'm not proposing that. I'm just asking the question.
And that's a good point for people to recognize, too. These are subtractions, okay? So you've got to look at this as being income that is removed from our tax base. Then you take that income and you times it by our rate structure, which we'll go into in just a minute. But basically, this is not a one-for-one by any means. Those are like credits. But these are valued by taking that income times the tax rate that is here in Oregon.
Oh,
okay, these are just the top five here, Oregon subtractions. And this is just for one particular year, 2002.
Excuse me just a minute, Elizabeth. Well, we have special guests who've come. And could you turn on the light just a minute, Christy, so Representative Butler can introduce our guests.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce you met my lovely bride Darlene yesterday, and this is our oldest daughter Heidi and her two children Kirsten, can you hold up your hand? There's Kirsten and Scott, can you wave? He's wondering what this is all about. I know that guy from somewhere. He sees my picture up on the post office wall, but this is one of the numbers across it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, and welcome to you. I'm sure that the children, particularly, will be raptly involved in our. For them, maybe, but you are not. She asked if it was nap time, and I said, not for us. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Thank you. Thanks, Christy. Got just a minute to get down.
Okay, so what we have here are just highlighting for 2003 for 2002. The total full year subtractions were $5.5 billion, and the largest one by far here was the federal income tax subtraction there of $2.3 billion. That represents 41% of the total here. And Social Security is right at about 21% of the total there at $1.1 billion. The federal pension income is right around 14%. Oregon tax refund is roughly 8%. And then our Oregon special medical deduction is about 7.7%. So basically, when you total all these top five up, this accounts for like 92% of the total Oregon subtraction. So you got them all right here with the majority of it right here in the federal deduction.
Representative Boquist has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just give me a maybe a swag or a speculation on the Social Security income, because we're looking down at the 1999 on the previous slide. You don't need to go back. And then it's going up. Can you give just what's the growth rate of this particular Social Security income? And what I'm really looking for is an idea of the increasing age of the workforce.
Well, Representative Boquist, I think, when you look at the elderly population, it's growing faster than the total population.
Precisely.
Yeah. Right. So the Social Security income is going to be growing faster, and especially in the next 10 years.
Follow up?
Yes. Sir.
Could you give me you think we're talking 5%, 10%, 3%, 1%, just a swag?
Yeah, Representative Boquist, I don't really remember. Do you, Paul, is it
4%? Madam Chair, I don't know the exact number. We can look at the forecast and see what the growth has been, but I would guess it's probably in the neighborhood of 3-4%. It's really been dominated by changes in the consumer price index because it's indexed to that. We've had relatively low inflation. The thing to keep in mind about the Social Security is that we've actually had a decline in recent years in the number of people entering their 60s, because that's the generation born in the 30s, and that was a small generation. Where we're really going to see the increase is in the coming years, starting in just a few years. So we expect that rate of growth to pick up significantly in the coming years, and of course we would really see it pick up if inflation picked up at the same time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, now this slide here really is just trying to highlight some of the trends that we've seen in itemized versus standardized tax returns. And basically it's going from 1990 to 2002, and looking at the drop here we've seen in standard, the purple here, the bright pink, is the standard number of standard returns or percent of the total. And so in 1990, what we saw here was standard was over 60% of the total tax returns. But now by 2002, you can see that basically that itemized returns haven't exceeded the standardized returns quite yet, but they're very close. So it's almost 50-50. And what this is telling you is that, the reason why most people itemize is because they've got a home. And then they can have the home mortgage interest deduction, then they can have a property tax deduction. And the reason why we've seen such a large increase in home ownership is because of the low interest rates, and it's made it more affordable for more people to be able to get into homes. And plus, over the last 10 years, we've seen a growth in personal income tax, and that makes it so that more people can afford homes. So basically, this is just kind of giving you a snapshot from the tax perspective of, increase in home ownership and what kind of effect. Now, here we're looking at then some of these trends and the largest federal itemized deductions that we're connecting to. And again, mortgage interest here is significant. I mean, just between 1999 and 2002 here, it grew, $500 million in just those 3 years or 4 years there. So it's a growing deduction. And the other thing that you'll begin to hear stories about or you have discussions about is with the mortgage interest, it's not limited. Okay, so it can be, you can have as much mortgage interest as you can claim. You can also have it on multiple homes. So that has gotten a lot of discussion in bills and things. Just as a caveat, so everyone's clear, it is pretty hard. Department of Revenue does not have data which separates out your mortgage interest on your primary residence versus the mortgage interest on, like, a second home. So it's very difficult to really try to get at that. I mean, and it's something that you certainly can do, but it's just recognizing the difficulties and limitations that we have to really get at an estimate for second home mortgages. So what we oftentimes suggest is that we just limit it. You could make it income dependent. You could limit the mortgage interest also by just the amount, you know, that you can have mortgage interest. So, and property taxes is the next largest federal itemized deduction, and this is significantly, obviously, smaller than mortgage interest, but it has been rising too. And as obviously, as property taxes go up, which we've been seeing a nice increase in property taxes, so does the deduction, as well as the number of people that are able to get into homes. Other charitable contributions is not far behind property taxes. The medical expense deduction, again, as we were talking about, that's the large medical expenses, those in which you have more than 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Miscellaneous expenses, those are really looking at things like legal expenses, you know, when you get to write off your CPA's expenses, that kind of thing is a deduction at the federal level. Educational charitable contributions are pretty small, and so is investment interest.
Elizabeth, I'm noting that it is our sincere hope to be out of here by 3. We're on page 8 of 20-something. And so in the interest of that, I'm going to ask her to kind of clip along here, and I'm not going to discourage questions, but I am going to discourage discussion, or discourage discussion, and keep it sort of to questions. And, okay? Thanks.
Madam Chairman, at the end, I can, you know, there's a few things I can probably, you know, just skip over.
Well, oh, no, we won't.
By all means, I know you couldn't dare not have every slide. Okay. Okay, so with basically the top 5 federal itemized deductions, this is, again, just illustrating to you in tax year 2002 how important and how significant home mortgage interest was. That was 38%. Property taxes were 11%. The two of those together are 50% of the total federal itemized deduction. So just be recognizing that when you're starting to look at different ways that you might change the current system. So as we talked about, we are connecting with the federal definition of taxable income. And then what we do is apply rates to then our Oregon taxable income. And the rates are set at 5, 7, and 9. It is a progressive tax rate. And then what we do is we look at credits. That, you know, when you times just the taxable income times the rate, that gives you a tax amount. And many of us just look at the tax tables, and that is all based on the rates of 5, 7, and 9. And then we look at the tax credits, with the biggest one being the personal exemption credit. And that's $151 in tax year 2004. And then after that equals the tax amount that you owe. So basically, we've kind of gone through a whole tax statement here. And basically, so everyone's clear on these tax rates and the structure, since it's a progressive tax rate, everyone gets a portion of their income paid at a 5% rate. And then if you have income above $2,600 if you're single, or $5,200 if you're joint, then the income between $5,200 and $13,000 for a joint return, meaning a family, you would pay a 7% rate. And then anything above $13,000 would be at the 9% rate. Now, obviously, we hit the 9% rate, our top rate, quite quickly here in Oregon. And it's been at this structure for, at least 10 years. So, you know, we used to have a more progressive tax structure. And it actually, even in the Department of Revenue has a nice table in the back of the statistic book, which gives the history of our personal income tax system and the rate. So if you want all that history, it's there. But the important point to recognize is, you know, we oftentimes just kind of, if we're kind of wanting to get something down and dirty as far as, you know, just an impact, we'll oftentimes just take 8% or 9% as far as a rate. Because when you look at our effective tax rate for most people who have pretty high income, it's going to be, you know, a little bit lower than 9%, but not a whole lot. Now, when we look at our credits, basically our credits are the trends that you see, and the personal exemption credit, I put it up here by itself because it's so much larger than the other credits. Okay, this really is the grandfather of all credits. It's, again, taking the number of exemptions that you have in your household and then timesing that by $151. So that is... And that is indexed each year. That $151 is indexed. That's the rate in 2004. Now, the thing to recognize about credits versus when we were talking about deductions and income taxes, subtractions and things, that's income deduction. These are credits, so they're one for one. They're more valuable. A credit is much more valuable than a deduction because you've got to take that income deduction times 8 or 9%.
Elizabeth, what is the personal exemption credit indexed to?
CPI.
Okay.
Changes in the CPI.
Thank you.
Yeah, I kind of have a tendency to just think, oh, they're indexed. And move on. Okay. Now, some of the other credits, just so everybody's kind of clear what we at least have out there as far as some of the bigger credits, we've got taxes paid to other states. And so this is basically on income that is being mutually taxed by two different states. So both states would be taxing this income. So then you would be getting a credit for the amount of tax that you paid on that income here in Oregon. And then we've got the working family tax credit, which in 2003 became refundable. So that's why, boom, you suddenly see this has grown significantly because now it's a refundable tax credit. Now, when I'm saying refundable, I'm meaning that If your tax liability is just $50 and you've got a working family tax credit of $100, if it's refundable, you're going to get a check for $50. Okay, so it comes back to you in terms of a refund. But if it's not refundable, then you would just be able to take 50% of that credit, just be able to take $50, and that's it. Just, you know, you eliminate your tax liability. So with working family credit is the only refundable personal income tax credit here in the state of Oregon right now. And again, that just went into effect in 2003. And one of the things that that kind of becomes policy issues if you were to consider another refundable credit is just whether or not you should be ranking these credits according, you know, should there be an order of usage of the credits and things. And so that's kind of discussions that we'll be having when we start looking at proposals to make maybe other credits refundable. And that's one of the things that I discussed in that research report on the 1997 legislation with the earned income and working family. Now, the political credit has been pretty stable. It's just $50 for a single person, $100 maximum. So since there's a pretty low maximum, you know, and there's kind of pretty much a stable number of people who give political contributions every year, it doesn't fluctuate a whole lot. The child care credit is a percent of the eligible child care expenses, and the retirement credit is given to low-income seniors. It's like 9% of your pension income. And then again, in 2002, we see that the personal exemption credit is 82%, okay, $374 million versus our total credits were $452 million in 2002. So 82% of all of our credits are in the form of personal exemption credit. And this just gives you the breakdown here of the taxes by percentages. And, again, this is exemption credit, 82%, taxes paid to other states, 3.5%, you know, the working family, this is in 2002, is only 3.1%. Well, it'll be much larger if you look at a pie chart like this for 2003 with it being refundable now. Well, here, since we were talking about families, I thought to feature this Oregon's Earned Income and Working Family Child Care Credits. This is a cute picture of my little boy.
Yeah, I'm glad to see him.
He's old, Zachary. So that's one of his Christmas photos. Well, basically, with the research report there, what I did is just kind of try to, you know, examine the trends since 1997, which was legislation in Senate Bill 388, which enacted the Earned Income and the Working Family Child Care Credit. And basically, the EIC, or Earned Income Credit, is 5% of the federal EIC. And the federal EIC is refundable, but here in Oregon, that is a non-refundable credit. EIC participants total more than 160,000 annually. So there's a lot of people that are impacted by this EIC credit. Now, of those 160,000 people, you know, one of the goals of the EIC was to provide tax relief to low-income Oregonians and even reduce and eliminate their income, their taxes that they had to pay. And so there, roughly what we found when we examine the 2003 tax data, there are, of these 160,000 people, 60,000 of them actually had Oregon tax that equaled zero after they used all of their earned income tax credit. So there are 100,000 people that basically, you know, paid some Oregon tax still. Even though they were eligible for an EIC. So it just kind of, you know, what you get into and what thing is part of the research report is whether or not if you wanted to expand this credit, do you want to expand it so more people can have their taxes reduced to zero, and that would be increasing then this percentage from 5% to something else, say 10 or 15, or do you want to make it refundable so that, like, we're saying instead of for those 60,000 people that have their taxes reduced to zero, well, they didn't get to use all of their EIC. So then they would get an additional check that would come to them if you made the tax credit refundable. So those are the policy decisions that you would, you know, be examining. And these are the kind of things that you can kind of begin to look at is who do you want to help? You know, who is it such that you want to increase the participation, or do you want to, the lowest income Oregonians get additional tax relief? So the EIC total amount claimed in 2003 was approximately $11 million. And then what we see with both of these credits is there is a household requirement to have earned income. So, and the working family child care credit is a percent of those child care expenses, and it's on a sliding scale depending on your income and the number of children. The working family child care claims total more than 25,000 annually, so it's significantly smaller as far as the number of people. And the tax in 2003, when it became refundable, was roughly $21 million. And this just gives you a table of some of the historical utilization of those two credits. And here, basically, with the Working Family Child Care Credit, in 2003, it's roughly $21 million in tax amount, where the EIC is about $12 million. Now, if you look at the average tax, which is kind of interesting, here in Oregon now, when the Working Family Child Care Credit is refundable, the average tax credit is $814 for the Working Family Child Care Credit versus EIC, which is $70. And then when you compare the EIC, which again is 5% of the federal EIC, it's roughly $70 versus $1,610 that was the federal average tax credit. And when you look at who is actually benefiting, you know, the distributional breakdown of these credits, you know, you can see that the working family child care tax credit impacts a lot more people. It has a slower phase out than the EIC, which is here in the purple, as far as the purple bars, and then the and basically most of the tax amount is between 20 and 25 thousand as far as adjusted gross income for the working family child care credit versus the EIC, where the largest amount is there in the category of 15,000 to 20,000. So the EIC is really targeting and benefiting more of the lower income participants, and that's somewhat because it's only 5% of the federal EIC. If this, you increase the percentage, you could then increase, you know, higher up as far as how much people could use the EIC. Now, this is just a table that tries to really kind of give you a sense of the tax burden here in Oregon, and it's kind of basically trying to give you a bigger picture of credits and what impact they have versus your effective net tax rate. And again, the tax rate is just looking at the amount of tax these different groups are paying divided by their income. And that then becomes the effective tax rate. Now, credits here, which is the blue area, the red area versus the blue area, which is the tax. But the red area here, you can see that credits are really tailored to help low-income taxpayers. But, and it does add some progressivity then to our overall effective tax rate, okay, which is what this black line here is showing you. For the lowest income Oregonians, they only pay an effective tax rate of a little less than 2%. And it grows as their income grows. And that progressivity, and the reason why the effective tax rate is growing, is because of the credit. Now, the credits kind of max out here at about $10,000 to $20,000 in adjusted gross income. Then that tax credit rate, the effective credit rate, which is rises to roughly about, you know, 1.8%, then it starts to decline. Well, that's because most of our income tax credits are phased out as income grows. So then we're seeing our effective rate of that credit then is being lowered. Well, then that means that our tax rate starts going up. So the effective tax rate goes from basically about, you know, a little less than 2% to up to nearly 8% for the highest the people with the most highest income in the state. So now this just kind of gives you, I've got a few graphs here, I'm just giving you a distributional breakdown of the different tax returns. So, and it's comparing 2002, which is the bright green bars, versus 1990. And what you can see is basically with 2002 now, we're seeing, you know, the number of returns that fall into the lowest income group is declining. I mean, that's been a drop there of almost 50,000 returns in this 12-year period. And what you're seeing, though, is then there's been a rise in the number of returns that are in the higher income groups, 40,000 to 60,000.
Go ahead, Representative.
Are those adjusted dollars or are those real dollars?
Representative, these are adjusted gross income. You know, as far as this here, as far as what we're measuring the returns, adjusted gross income from that tax statement.
But are these I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Representative.
Are these 2002 dollars adjusted dollars to 1990?
Representative Riley, no. Okay. No, they've not been adjusted at all.
Thank you.
It's just looking at which ones fell into these categories in that particular year.
Thank you.
So basically what we see is we've got about, we went up about 23% in total returns between 1990 and 2002 over that 12-year period. But the main thing that to recognize here is just the way our distribution is changing and as far as the amount of income that you're seeing more income in a larger number of returns. And that is going to be played out then in the amount of tax they pay. And then here are some of the components then of adjusted gross income. And this kind of gives you just at least basic understanding of, you know, when we started that tax statement with federally adjusted gross income, well, what was all in there? Well, these are major components that were in that total federally adjusted gross income. We obviously have wages and tips in there. Then we've got in investment and dividends here. And then we've got business income. And what this is, you know, they kind of separate out sole proprietors. So these are the sole proprietors that are in this, they call it Schedule C, and for businesses. And then we've got capital gains income in here. Well, capital gains is only 3%, as you can see here. And what we've seen over the 1990s, and what Paul was referring to too in his presentation yesterday, was just the growth in capital gains and what portion it became of our adjusted gross income. Now, pensions here is 6%. Miscellaneous refers to our Schedule E income, which are things like the S corporations and the rental income, estate and trust royalties. So there's kind of a hodgepodge of income here in the miscellaneous category. And then with the other income, this basically is looking at the other components of like Social Security and things like that. Now, what we see in 2002, and again, this is not as high as 2000 was, but in 2002, we've seen a slight growth here in wages. We've seen, you know, a pretty big growth here in miscellaneous as far as their miscellaneous went from 3.2 to 5.2 here. Pensions grew significantly. Pensions before was only 6.2, and now it's 10.1. And capital gains grew, but it grew from 3% to about 3.7%. But again, 2002 was not a good year for capital gains. If you look at 2000, well, then the, you know, percent of the total is around 9%. So, you know, our capital gains percent of our income, you know, got quite significant at the end of the 1990s. But now we've seen that drop. And again, that was one of the things that dropped significantly, caused us to go into our recession. Now, this kind of gives you an understanding here of the change in some major components then of adjusted gross income between the height in 2000 versus 2002. Now, obviously, as we have a recession, then we have unemployment income that goes up. So we saw an increase there between 2000 and 2002 of 180% for unemployment insurance income. We saw capital gains drop 58%. We saw dividends and interest drop 28%. IRA distributions, that was, you know, pegged against the stock market and things, and that dropped 12%. Alimony, well, that's always a good one for growth. 8.6%. And miscellaneous, again, this is due to there's quite a growth. When we start talking about corporations, you'll see the growth that we've been seeing here in Oregon with S corporations, and so that's really reflected then in this miscellaneous income. And then businesses, which are the sole proprietor, that grew just slightly. And the sole proprietors are not growing as fast as the S-Corps and the LLC and partnerships. Now, the distribution of adjusted gross income components, I think the main thing is just to look at the shape of this and recognize what we're seeing. And you're seeing kind of a bell-shaped distribution where you've got, you know, the most of the income here is in the $40,000 to $60,000 adjusted gross income. You've got 23% of the total. It's right here, and you've got significantly more, less than 40,000, versus what we're going to see here. We see an exponential type of a shape of a graph, and what this tells you is that more of the income now is in the 100,000 plus category of filers. And what you should also see is just the big distribution here between. We've got such a variety of income here that people in the 100,000 category are having. Wages and stuff don't create. I mean, it's roughly about around not quite. It was a little over 50% of their total income is wages. But then you've got dividends and business and capital gains, largest category, is in this 100,000 plus. And you really don't see, like, this miscellaneous income anywhere else. I mean, it's really small here, except for this 100,000, which tells you that, you know, sole proprietors and things, that, you know, they're the ones who would be getting dividends then. And so it's these larger income households that are really the small businesses and things. Pensions. Pensions are large here in the 60,000 to 100,000 category. And there, you've got some pension income here. But the pension income is seen in all these different income groups, slightly. And this other, you know, includes things like unemployment income, and that's why you see that in the kind of the lower income groups. Now, to look at just kind of an average adjusted gross income, and this just kind of helps you see how much things have really kind of changed over the last 12 years. Again, on a statewide average, and this excludes all of the tax returns which have losses. So basically, 2002 average is $42,736 as far as an adjusted gross income. And again, you can think of adjusted gross income kind of like total income. There's very few adjustments at the federal level that are brought forward to, you know, really the point at which we start with the federal connection and bringing that into our tax forms and stuff. So this really is kind of our measure of total income is adjusted gross income. And in 1990, you can see that the increase here is 24,995. And the biggest difference here really is the 100,000 category, and that's because of what we just saw in the previous slide. That group has really changed as far as having a much different and more diverse range of income components, and that has caused their average then to go up to almost 200,000 versus in 1990, where it was probably only about 175.
Elizabeth, anticipating Representative Riley's question, these are real dollars, not adjusted for any changes in value. Well, I asked for you because it was a good question. Yes, Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, just one quick question. You excluded tax returns with losses. Is there an average of that? I mean, how many tax returns show losses? Or you can get back with me later for the good of the order.
Yeah, it's in here. It's not real large, 1 or 2%.
Thank you. It's a good question,
okay.
And she can
get back to me later.
Believe me, she knows.
Now, this is just really graphically. I just kind of like to give you these tables, these graphs of every county in the state, and then you can just kind of use them at your own leisure, just to kind of give you a graphical illustration of where your district is in terms of, you know, the average and stuff. So this is the statewide average adjusted gross income for 2002, and that's at $41,210, and this includes all returns, even losses. So that's why the average is a little bit lower. And as you can see here, basically, the adjusted gross income for most of the, and there's only two counties here, Clackamas and Washington, that are above 50,000. Okay, and there's only then, again, six counties that are between 40,000 and 50,000. So the majority of them, the majority of the state is between 30,000 and 40,000 as far as an average adjusted gross income. And then a few of the eastern and southern Oregon counties are in the range of 0 to 29,999. And this is just then, again, the average tax. And what this, you know, really kind of shows you is the range that we see, with the highest tax being here in Washington County at $3,237, and the lowest tax average here being Wheeler at $1,270. So that's a difference there of almost $2,000 as far as an average tax difference. It's, you know, it should kind of illustrate to you that great, you know, range and disparity that we're now seeing between kind of the urban Portland metro area and the rural areas of the state. And this is just one way in which you can reflect that. through the tax and the adjusted gross income. And then this one just shows you where we came from. In 1990, there wasn't this kind of, you know, difference, not so dramatic. And so you see that you only had four counties that were between 1,500 and 1,999. And the metro area was obviously still a higher average tax by county, but it wasn't the sheer difference there that we're seeing now.
Wow.
Now, this is just for your own information, because sometimes we do get bills dealing with the charitable checkoff donations. And this is something that basically we have about four of them that are permanent: Alzheimer's Research, Stop Domestic Violence, Child Abuse, and the AIDS. Or actually, I think there's five of them that are permanent. And then the rest of them rotate. So we have about 17 on our tax statement that people can choose from and check off if they'd like to donate money to them. And then this is just something that basically, so everyone's clear, we do tax, you know, people who earn their income in the state of Oregon, in the sense that if you lived here and then you moved away, then you would only be paying part year taxes. But if you're a full year resident, then we tax your income regardless of where it is. Okay? We work. So basically that's how we distinguish it. Non-residents will get taxed here if they have Oregon income earned here, like they're an absentee landlord or they're commuting from Vancouver to Portland to work. Then they've earned their income here in Oregon, and then they will be a non-resident and they will get taxed. So just so everyone's clear, we take a portion of their total income. You know, so if, say you're, you know, a non-resident, you're just going to be paying income taxes on that portion that you earned here in Oregon. If you left the state, you're a part-year resident, you'd only be paying income taxes on a proportion of the time that you were here in the state of Oregon. And this is just how you would calculate that. Now, with the kicker stuff, just so everyone's clear, what is the kicker? At the end of each biennium, if the corporate income tax revenues exceed our COS, or close of session estimate, by 2% or more, and those are just the corporate income taxes alone, then what we do is the entire amount that is then above 2% is credited to corporate taxpayers. And this is given to them in terms of a credit on their corporate taxes. Now, what we also do with the kicker is have other general fund revenues. So everything else but corporate, okay, all of your general fund revenues, and there's a whole, you know, when we look at the forecasts and stuff, you can see a whole list of all those different general fund revenue sources. And if those exceed the close of session estimate by 2% or more, then the entire amount is refunded to personal income taxpayers. And that is based on the most recent tax year. So say, well, when we had our last kicker in the 01-03 biennium, or I'm sorry, in the 99-01 biennium, we based it on the last tax year that we had, which was 2000. Now, here is the just the history of the personal income tax versus the corporate tax refund, and the last personal income tax one we had was $254 million, or roughly 6% of our total tax liability in that particular tax year, and then corporate did not have a kicker that particular biennium. Our last corporate kicker was in the 95-97 biennium of $203 million. Now, right now, this is the important thing, is in the 03-05 biennium, we have a corporate tax rebate forecasted at $43 million right now. And again, that could change by the end of the biennium. Now, basically, as far as the, you know, just a few quick tips in thinking about different policy changes. You know, and the personal income tax areas, you know, and I work in the corporate area too, but, you know, with personal income tax, I do a lot of things that don't even become bills. And so, you know, you're welcome to come and just say, well, gee, I have this idea and I'd like to run it by somebody and tell me how much money it would generate. You know, that is more, that I do a lot of that. So you're welcome to come and just get me to run some numbers for you and just, you know, see what kind of an impact you're going to get. And I think the main thing is, you know, to think hard about who you're targeting. And I can, you know, I have a personal income tax calculator, and that's not the same thing as you were talking about yesterday, OTM, you know, the Oregon Tax Incident Model. The personal income tax calculator is just takes a sample of the personal income tax returns, and then it calculates changes, and has, you know, various codes to calculate changes by different income groups. And then it forecasts then the impact by the different income groups. So I can give you a good distributional breakdown. It's a static impact. So everybody needs to be clear, too. When you're 90% of the revenue impacts you'll be seeing in personal income tax area are going to be static impacts. It means it doesn't take into consideration any feedback effects, you know, employment changes or anything like that. All of that is not done on the majority of the revenue impacts that we do. They're just not real big changes. But I can sure give you these distributional breakdowns through my personal income tax calculator. So I do these static revenue impacts the majority of the time, just to kind of give you an understanding of what could be an impact. And then, you know, what we're going to be targeting is just trying to figure out how much is this going to change as far as generate an additional revenue, as well as who is going to be impacted by your policy change. And an important thing, too, is just to remember about targeting, you know, in terms of if you need to narrow the focus of your ideas and things, and that's stuff that we can discuss. And then to just know the ease of administration, okay, and that really gets into when we start talking about these federal adjustments or, you know, various deductions are much easier than exclusions and stuff to be able to try to tax and stuff. So just knowing the ease of administration for the Department of Revenue, you really want to be, you know, thinking about, well, what additional costs would there be from this policy change and what kind of auditing possibilities in particular. If this is something that's self-selected, the Department of Revenue is going to have a really hard time trying to audit it, you know, because they're not going to have a base in which to know who should be paying this tax or who should be getting this credit. So it's just, you know, these are kind of basic stuff, but it comes back to, you know, these being pretty fundamental too. The most good policy changes is just trying to keep in mind what kind of ramifications you're going to have from them. So that's really it. Here. I'm sorry. I guess I did have the large policy. So when we talk about OTM and the Oregon Tax Incident Model, we're really talking about large policy changes, and so that's when that model gets used. And we will have more detail on that, and additional time will be given to just talking about some of the stimulus effects. And that model is designed for that. It's designed to really help you see, okay, if we combine all these different policy changes together, then what's the result? And it gives you a distributional breakdown as well as feedback effects to knowing where the employment changes would be, you know, what kind of additional revenue would you see in the property tax area or the general fund.
Elizabeth, thank you. And you did a fantastic job of landing us on time. Any burning questions for those who all of you? I have to admit that when she got to maps, I sighed in relief because maps are easier than charts. But one announcement from the chair, Ken Strobeck, who is the current executive of League of Oregon Cities, or Associated Oregon Cities, I forget the name of it. At any rate, he is a former Revenue Committee chair, and he has invited the committee to a lunch on February 4th, so you might put that in your Palm Pilots or schedules or whatever you do.
Sticky pads,
and I'm sure you will hear more. But that's just a heads up that the chair asked me to deliver to you.
That's lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
February 4th. And if, Paul, do you have any closing remarks? You're looking like you just have to tell us something.
I have one more along those same lines. The chair would like to spend the Friday meetings basically out of the building and doing some optional tours for the committee. And we have contacted the Lottery Commission, and they're setting up their facilities at the Lottery Building for next Friday, the 18th. That would be from 1 to 3 out there. So we'll give you more details on that. And,
yes.
But it would be for in lieu of meeting in this room next Friday, the 18th.
Anything else for the good of order? Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you also for the picture of your little Zachary. I've asked about it, and it showed up right there. Okay?
Yes.
All right. We are adjourned for the day. Thank you very much.
Teacher.
Don't run out. Sticky notes.
Sticky notes.